Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 30th of June. First hour of our program today, our guest says that people are actually now sicker as they die, and some find that treatments become a greater burden than the illness was. Families may push for treatment, but there are worse things than having someone you love die. Here's what's happening right now. The average time spent in hospice and palliative care, which stresses, of course, comfort and quality of life, is falling because people are starting it too late. In 2008, one-third of people who received hospice care had it for a week or less. Hospitalizations during the last 6 months of life are going up from 1,302 per 1,000 Medicare recipients in 1996 to 1,441 in 2005. Treating chronic illness in the last 2 years of life gobbles up nearly one-third of all Medicare doctors. Our guest this hour is Dr. Ira Byock. He is Director of Palliative Care at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, Professor of Anesthesiology and Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School, author of Dying Well, The Prospect of Growth at the End of Life. He's past president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, and in the 90s, he was a co-founder and principal investigator for the Missoula Demonstration Project, a community-based organization in Montana dedicated to the research and transformation of end-of-life experience locally as a demonstration of what is possible nationally. And he will talk about what is possible during the course of this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I know many of you have dealt with end-of-life issues and you didn't know what to do and you wonder about all treatments possible at the end of life when you know that it may extend a life only for perhaps a couple weeks or a couple months. At what point should we say that's enough treatment and learn to accept the fact that we die? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you're so welcome to do that. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. Ira Byock, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So tell me, I'm very interested in this community-based work that you did. What is a demonstration of what is possible nationally when it comes to end of life?
Well, Kathleen, thanks for asking. I lived and worked in Missoula, Montana for many years, and as a physician there, I was involved actually both in the emergency department as well as being the hospice medical director for our community for about 10 years. We decided during the 90s that as a community, we really wanted to explore what it would be like to live in community with one another rather than merely in proximity to one another around issues of illness, aging, caregiving, dying, and grief. And we really tried to look from a community perspective, a lot of different perspectives, really, about what that looks like from, you know, as clinicians, of course, as doctors, nurses, others, EMTs even, pharmacists, but also what does it look like if you're a teacher working in the grade schools or in the high schools? What does it look like if you're a minister in a faith community, even as a funeral director? How about as an attorney? What does that look like to be in community with people? And how do we serve people through this inherently difficult times of life, but also, you know, frankly, often some of the most rich times of life, even though they may be stressful and sad?
I love the way that you describe that, living in a community, and that we all have that at this time of life. You wrote a piece recently, well, it was about a year ago, in the New Health Dialogue, in which you talk about your care for an 83-year-old man that you said you'll call Dennis. Do you remember that story? Because I'd like for you to tell it.
Well, I remember the story. I actually remember Dennis very well.
Great.
This gentleman, it's a pseudonym, his name wasn't Dennis, but he was an elderly man who lived in the North Country around here, and I live in New Hampshire. I teach at Dartmouth Medical School and practice at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. And Dennis had been referred to us after he had fallen at home, cut his head, came to the local hospital up in the North Country by ambulance, was evaluated there, found to be in congestive heart failure, transferred down here to the referral hospital. We have a big, you know, academic medical center here. And here he was found to have what's called critical aortic stenosis. He had a very calcified, tight valve in his heart that was causing congestive heart failure. And that's why he fell, and that's why he cut his head. And it turns out when I delved into his case with a resident physician I was seeing him with, that he had actually had generally failing health over a few years. He had been on dialysis in a small dialysis clinic that's up north. But his main complaint was that he simply had trouble at home. He had nobody to help him with the, you know, 15 or more medications he was taking on any given day. He had difficulty just getting up and dressed and making his own meals and getting around. He still went to church, and he got his hair cut once a month or so and enjoyed interactions occasionally at the senior center, though it was hard for him to get out. But he was well-loved in town and had many friends. Now, when we looked at his health problems, the doctors said, well, we could try to get your heart valve fixed, but you'd have a very high risk of having a stroke. Dennis decided he didn't want any of that. He just wanted to go home and live out his life as well as he could. He was okay with continuing dialysis, at least for the moment. And, you know, but he said, no, I'm fine. I'll just go home. I would love to get some help at home, however. So we worked hard to get him home. I was very discouraged that I couldn't get home health to see him because under Medicare rules, you have to be strictly homebound for home health to see you. And yet, he was getting out to get his hair cut and go to the, right, you know, go to church when he was able to get a ride. I couldn't get him hospice care until he was ready to give up his dialysis and embrace his dying, which he wasn't ready to do just yet. And so, you know, with real frustration, we had to send him home and, you know, have him continue to lurch from problem to problem. As soon as he has a problem, notice that there is no restrictions. The Medicare pays for his ambulance, pays for his emergency department visit, paid for his cardiac catheterization, and would have paid for his open heart surgery had he not refused.
Goodness.
But the basic problems of living, the challenges of living at home alone, weren't paid for because, of course, they're not medical. And I think I reflect in the piece I wrote that the root word of the roots of the word patient comes from the Latin, one who suffers.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually force people to become patients. We force them to suffer before, as a society, we respond to their needs. And I wrote this during the midst of the healthcare, you know, reform debate, where, you know, people were, political people were lobbying, you know, charges back and forth. And I said, you know, the real opportunities we have to improve quality and control costs come before we even talk about health care. You know, if you want to really improve quality and reform health care, you have to look outside of health care.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at how people live.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be a responsive community. As much as I like patient-centered care, that's not going to fix it. We need person-centered care that really meets people where they're
exactly.
at and really begins to prevent the problems, like had Dennis had a visiting nurse or a parish nurse or a Stevens minister nurse to see him at home or somebody from the community center who was seeing him, perhaps his fall could have been prevented. Perhaps, you know, he wouldn't have had to come to the hospital at all, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we need to think more broadly than just fixing health care as if, you know, as if that's going to do it. I believe, and I hope we'll get to talk about this in a bit, Kathleen, I think as a society, it's time that we grew the rest of the way up. You know, we age, hopefully, if we live that long. Eventually, we all die. We just need to get over it, you know, and really have a more mature discussion about how we can live well and care responsively for one another through the very end of life.
I've told this story on the air before. My very dear father, who I love so much, died 2.5 years ago, and he was 92 years old at the time, living by himself in Chicago, and had not been to a doctor since World War II. He was a stubborn Irishman, but pretty darn healthy. And that's exactly what happened to him. I had to maneuver the medical system, and it was okay once we did that, but trying to figure out, you know, when he could be on hospice and what kind of care he would get and what kind of hospice and why we couldn't have somebody deliver his meals after he fell in the bathtub and was there for 2 days by himself and have him care for his medications and keep him company at home. And we just couldn't do it. You know, there was just no way to do that. And that's what he would have wanted. And it just, you're knocking your head against the wall. You're just, oh my gosh, this is too much. Why haven't we dealt with what you described with Dennis, what I experienced with my father, and which millions of people in this country, I'm sure, are dealing with right now?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons we haven't dealt with it. It's a complex problem, and it will take more than one piece of legislation or one tweak in a regulation to fix. That's one thing. But I honestly think there are some cultural roots why we're not dealing with it. One, it's depressing to talk about. And our political candidates and our elected leaders don't want to touch it. They don't want to talk about anything having to do with death and dying. For one thing, it brings up, you know, the polar provocative ideas of, on the one hand, assisted suicide, and on the other hand, you know, that we're killing granny. The politicians have learned you just don't want to talk about death and dying. For another thing, they don't want to talk about it because it's sort of depressing and it doesn't often uplift. And any politician knows they want to inspire and they want to be hopeful, and this all seems so daunting. But in fact, some research that I've done and I know from public surveys around the country, there actually is an enormous consensus, a strong consensus about what Americans do want through the end of life. The large majority of people want to be at home, if possible, during their last days of life. The most important thing that people say by far is they don't want to be a burden to their family. They don't want to die in physical agony. They don't want to lose their dignity. Well, those things, you know, we can set aside assisted suicide on the one hand and whether or not we do CPR on everybody on the other hand, and generally agree that we need to reformulate our social policies and our healthcare systems to deliver on the promise of people being clean and comfortable and having their inherent dignity respected as they die.
I'm with you.
Much we can do.
Right. What about this other part of all of this, the end of life, what's been called exhaustion medicine, where you can't, and if you've been with somebody dying, you don't know exactly when it's going to happen, but we know when illnesses have become incurable, and yet you're given another round of chemotherapy, you're given another blood transfusion, you're given so much to keep you alive. Can you talk about why, how much of that is taking place, the cost of that, and whether or not, in order to change healthcare and reduce some of the costs, we're simply going to have to change our thinking about that?
Yeah, I don't think the motive is to save money. In fact, right now, you know, we spend an enormous amount of resources and provide huge amounts of aggressive life-sustaining care, and still people die. What we need to do is really think about, first and foremost, for ourselves and the people we love, what would it look like for us to die well, or for the person we love to die well? And then to begin to match the medical treatments that actually make sense and help achieve that goal as well as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since we're mortal, you know, no one gets out of this one alive. And what I see is not insensitive doctors or doctors or hospitals with profit motives trying to sell as much health care to people as possible so that they can, you know, make budget or make bonuses. That's really a fantasy. It just, it may happen somewhere, but honest to goodness, I don't see it. What I do see, however, is a lot of people who have serious life-threatening illnesses who do not want to be dead, and their doctors who do not want their patients to die, and who have an enormous amount of medical technology and scientific progress to bring to bear to keep people alive. And in that context, the outcomes I see range from the utterly ridiculous to the absolutely sublime. You know, in the absolutely sublime are the occasional case of people who survive and actually do very well against all odds and against any expectations and really are the miracle cures, and they happen. But I see an enormous amount of people who, in the quest for life, which is precious after all, and we're all, you know, about affirming life, in the quest for life, they continue to turn to the doctors and the technology that can keep them alive or keep their loved one alive. And what ends up happening is that life begins to wane anyway, and people end up in this limbo state, which for many people and certainly many families eventually becomes something even worse than
that. Yes, right.
And,
it does.
And, you know, what I think is possible is that we can begin to integrate the fact that every life eventually ends, and that this last chapter of life, whenever it happens, needs to be cared for and honored with the same degree of respect and reverence as every other phase of life. And I don't have, that's not an algebra equation that pops out a clear answer, but it changes the tensions that we sit with so that we begin to sit with this balance of when is medicine right and when is more better and when is more not better, mm-hmm. when is more less.
We just need somebody to come back and make the round of talk shows and say, I died, and you get to see everybody you loved and all your dogs, and don't worry.
Yeah, well, I think we need to tell stories in our culture of what a positive, hoped-for outcome looks like that includes somebody we love actually dying. I honestly think that the limit here is that we cannot imagine anything positive related to the time of life we call dying.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it hard for all of us to work toward. It's almost as if, you know, all we know is what we want to avoid. You know, we don't want to die in pain. We don't want to die undignified. We don't want to be a burden to our families. We don't want to end up in a nursing home. You know, heaven forbid, doctor.
Right.
You know, I have so many people who've said, oh, just push me down the stairs.
Right.
Shoot me before you do that. And we don't want to leave our families with debts and, you know, bills to pay and go through all of our life savings. So just think about that. It's as if our vision of the good death was a photographic negative. It's only defined by the things we know we want to avoid.
Hmm.
And that makes it really hard to move towards something and to do planning and preparation that actually moves us forward. So doctors who really do care about their patients, they're no further along culturally than the rest of us, and all they want to do is to keep their patient from dying. And patients want to keep themselves, or family wants to keep the people they love from dying. And that's, you know, that keeps us almost paralyzed.
Let's welcome phone calls for you, Doctor. We have many of them. Dr. Ira Byock is our guest this hour. He's the author of Dying Well and has a website, dyingwell.org, which you may want to look at. Director of Palliative Care at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, Professor of Anesthesiology and Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. And we're pleased to have him with us this hour. Our phone number, one line is open, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Wednesday, Time Magazine has its annual history issue out right now. And on the cover is Thomas Edison, who had, can you believe this, 1,093 inventions. We're going to be speaking with the author of one of the pieces on how he invented the electric light bulb. And we'll also be speaking with Thomas Edison's great-grandson. So stay tuned for that, hour number two. We go to phone calls now, starting with Dennis from Waukesha. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, good morning. Excellent program. Could you tell me what is the difference in terms of how European countries treat end-of-life issues and the European society as a whole? Do they discuss death, or are they like us and make believe they can buy their way out of it?
I'm not an expert in European culture, and I think European culture is not one thing but a patchwork of cultures, of course. I do think that, in general, Western developed nations share in common this sense that somehow death can be forestalled, and medicine can always be invoked to somehow intervene and keep mortality at bay. So I think, you know, historically the transcultural lessons may be more valid in our own, looking at our own culture, but we know historically that people were more accepting of, you know, the fact that there is some finality of life. And dying was not seen as a medical event. It was seen, as I believe it still, of course, is, as a profoundly personal event, and an event within the life of the individual and family. In the 1930s and 40s, certainly, things changed in our country. There was so much rapid progress in medicine that I know my parents, who grew up during that time, have said, you know, we saw people come back from the hospital who had gone to the hospital with things like serious pneumonias or infections or, you know, even appendicitis that had burst, who would have died, but now they came back and they were well. And what we learned culturally during this period and the period of dramatic progress in surgery and cardiology and other things was that the best care possible meant going to the hospital. And if someone was really sick, later, having them in the ICU. But what we need to somehow relearn in this new, you know, third millennium era in which we live is that at some point in time, the best care possible does not equate to just more medical treatments for our diseases. And that's something that I think, frankly, there is no precedent for. Dennis, we're actually, you know, having to learn this for the first time, because we're in a period where, for the first time in history, we can, in fact, replace failing organ functions, at least for a time, and we can treat infections. And often, from a purely biological perspective, sometimes we can prolong life beyond which at least most people would consider it to be meaningful.
So let's talk about that at some point in time. Who should decide that? What's the role of the medical community in making that information be known? What's our responsibility in terms of letting people know how much we want? What's the family's responsibility?
You know, to the extent possible, it ought to be one's individual personal choice about what treatments they want. And you know, the balance here is starts with what your current quality of life is. You know, I'm thinking of somebody, for instance, who's living with a progressive cancer, a situation where I meet people almost every day in that circumstance. And at some point in time, the next treatment being offered, maybe it's the third or fourth round of chemotherapy or a combination of chemotherapy and radiation treatments, at some point in time, the question arises, look at your current quality of life and the extent to which it's worth sustaining to you, and then look at the risks of whatever treatments being offered compared to the potential benefits of those treatments. And that sort of balance is how I often help people sort through what their preferences would be. I think doctors, again, want to keep people alive. They want the best care for their patients, but they often look for the options solely in medical treatments. And while that is often the right thing to do early in the course of treatment, at some point in time, the best care possible needs to prioritize personal goals, including the quality of each day and the ability to really complete one's life, more than simply the biological goals of, you know, restoring or keeping the kidneys functioning or, you know, the liver from failing. So that those decisions need to be made in a shared manner with physicians, but usually with families, as individuals begin to sort through the potential benefits, the biological risks of treatment, but also sort of the opportunity costs, if you will, of accepting more medical treatment.
Thank you, Dennis, for your call. Matt in Middleton is next. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. I really like what the doctor's saying. However, there's a few things that concern me, and I think this is what's causing the major backlash to the healthcare reform bill by so many people, is the term dignity is used a lot, but it's not defined as to what dignity is. And many people have a different idea of what dignity is and who is going to decide what dignified is. Now, in a person, I'm Catholic, and the way I was always taught by my religion is when you get near the end of your life, I mean, again, we don't see death as the end, but a new beginning. But beyond that, I was always taught that if your life is failing, a doctor is morally bound to provide life-sustaining faculties to the patient, and so long as those procedures or other help is not going to cause more harm to the patient than allowing them to die. But then that was prefaced with, we always consider food, nutrition, water, any type of nutrition as essential elements that we would never withhold from a patient, irrespective of their current medical state. Now, if I'm old and I'm having a hard time deciding what I'm supposed to do, I have congestive heart failure or some other thing, I would want to feel that my family was going to be there for me to help me, not that I'm going to have to rely on strangers. Not that that's wrong, but I think that's the big breakdown over the last 50 years, is we no longer have support from our families, that when we get sick or we get old, we can count on my son or my cousins to come and help me if I need that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bayek.
Well, you've said some very interesting and important things, Matt. I share a number of your perspectives. For one thing, I think dignity is an inherent quality of the human condition. And so I think, we need to stipulate that all people are inherently dignified. That's not some religious assertion on my part or some New Age platitude. Indeed, the preamble of the United Nations 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the preamble starts with the statement, whereas recognition of the inherent dignity of and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. They stipulate right there that we, as a civilized world, recognize that the inherent dignity of all human beings. So I object to the hijacking of the word dignity by the pro-assisted suicide movement. People are inherently dignified. They can be made to feel undignified if they are treated in a disrespectful, dismissive manner. But I think that simply being ill or old or needing help from others does not make one undignified. It simply really makes one human. You know, caring for one another is a species-specific characteristic of the human race. And so we need to get over that one. And I frankly think we need to take back the word dignity from the political movement to legalize physician-assisted suicide. Whatever one believes about the wisdom or lack of wisdom in doing that legally as social policy, dignity needs to be stipulated as just part of who we are.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. Beth in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I heard a little bit, and I wanted to call because about 12 years ago, my dear friend, who was a good friend for years, married my brother. She was diagnosed with leukemia, which in my mind, when we heard Pan had leukemia, it was like dead, which isn't, you know, great, but that's the scariest part. But I became really involved with her because I was a stay-at-home mom and was able to go during the day. And I found it so fascinating that it wasn't dead today. The oncology floor really represented how you live while you're maybe going to die or maybe going to get better. But the reason I called is that I said to Pam, you know what? No one teaches us about dying, death. Finality, it's avoided, and I was raised Catholic and not active, but I was taught that when they die, then we're supposed to celebrate for their new life. Well, that, for a rational mind, I couldn't comprehend it. And so I continued with Pam throughout her treatment. She did have a bone marrow transplant. Every day, just being with her and saying, do you want to eat that, or do you want me to run out and get you something? That is what I found to be the best lesson is, at the moment, what did Pam need? Did she need to be left alone? One day she said, I don't want all these cards and posters all over. I'm not a messy person. I said, you don't have to have them all over. So I took them down and put them in a basket, and she felt better. And I found that the moment, taking care of the person at the moment and knowing their personality, helping her, was actually a pretty fantastic last year knowing Pam. We had a lot of laughs about the human condition, and I won't go on because I have a ton of stuff that we observed, but I do want to say that when she had her bone marrow transplant and she couldn't smell flowers, fresh flowers, she couldn't have fresh fruit, she couldn't have a lot of things, she couldn't see my kids, which thought of her as a second parent. What happened is when the bone marrow transplant and they found out that it didn't work, okay, it was going to come back and it was going to kill her. Her doctor said that she could go back to her family physician. And I came in and Pam said, this is really disturbing. I feel like I'm being kicked out. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, they told me that I can go back home and I could go see my family physician. And I go, that is freaky. So we talked to the social worker on the oncology floor and she explained that the doctors are very uncomfortable with this next phase.
Oh.
Like, they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we looked at each other like, whoa, okay. And being problem solvers, it was like, all right, so it's kind of in our hands. So they gave the option that Pam could come back there and die or go to a hospice. She chose to come back there because the people were wonderful. She didn't have a big family. I was probably her primary person. Her husband, who dearly loved her, had a hard time with dying illness. It was amazing. So she went home. He took care of her. It was wonderful. I thought it was fascinating that her brain started going. She didn't remember things. She wondered why she was being brought to the hospital again. And I said, basically want to check you out again. And this was when she was going to die. She came out of the car and she goes, wow, why is everyone treating me like I'm so delicate? I said, we adore you, Pam. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. Dr. Byack.
Well, I ache for you. I can feel how much you love
Pam. Yes.
This is just part of life, and I can't romanticize it. I don't want to glorify it, but it's part of life. I think so many of us in hospice and palliative care have learned so much from, frankly, from Christian and Catholic theology. theologians and ethicists. I mean, a lot of my own ethical background comes from people like Edmund Pellegrino and Pope John Paul II, Archbishop, Cardinal Joseph Bernardin, all of whom, embrace the reverence of life, as do those of us in this field. But in order to truly, authentically affirm life, one needs to affirm all of life. And that includes the part that we call dying. And I think it's a misperception to think that Catholic teaching requires people to go through CPR or to have medically administered nutrition and hydration. To be honest, John Paul II did not have medically administered nutrition and hydration. He didn't go on a ventilator. He didn't have CPR at the end of his life. Mother Teresa had none of those things. I have on my desk, I have a quote from Cardinal Bernardin from a letter he wrote to the United States Supreme Court opposing assisted suicide. And he said, "A person who decides to forego treatment does not necessarily choose death. Rather, he chooses life without the burden of disproportionate medical intervention." He was understanding that, life is a precious gift, but it is a finite gift. At some point in time, at least this life ends.
Mm-hmm.
And where we go from here is open to debate. But we know that this life ends, and to truly affirm life, we have to affirm it all.
Thank you, Beth, very much for your call. We'll pause for a moment and return. Our guest this hour is Dr. Ira Byock, Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and a professor of anesthesiology and community and family medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. He is the author of Dying Well, which has become a standard in the field, and also The Four Things That Matter Most, which is used as a counseling tool by palliative care and hospice programs, as well as within pastoral care. We have one line open if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd care to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program, Thomas Edison is on the cover of the current issue of Time Magazine, their 9th annual special, The History Issue. We'll be talking about how he is relevant today and we can't talk about all of his inventions because there were so many of them. One of our guests is his great-grandson, who's a professor of literature. Back to phone calls. Mary is next from Wausau. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. My experience includes having both my mother and father having died. In 1987, my mother had a sudden heart attack, and the family needed to make a decision about removing the respirator. In 1993, my father was diagnosed with metastatic cancer, and his oncologist ordered chemotherapy. My father agreed to that without discussion with the family. With the chemo, though, he nearly died because he had a strong reaction against it. And with that, my family were informed about the cancer progressing. And he did end up in a nursing home. The family, because I'm a hospital chaplain, I knew that hospice would be an option, and for 18 months before my father died, hospice was involved with his care. My brother was his main caregiver. Unfortunately, my two sisters were not able to visit him very often, and my brother was able to ask hospice all kinds of questions about my dad's care from time to time. And towards the end of my dad's life, myself, along with my brother, made the decision to not provide my father with blood transfusions because it was becoming apparent he was becoming weaker. And if you have blood transfusions, that gives a temporary reprieve. And my father did have a stroke, and he did die. I just really encourage people to consider hospice earlier, especially if the person has a diagnosis of a terminal condition. And I do believe in the dignity of every person. And I also have been a Catholic, and I really believe that some of the decisions that the family made in relation to my father were related to common sense and not wanting to spend a lot of money that the medical system would have incurred.
All right, let's get a response, Mary. Thanks for your call. Dr. Bayek.
Hi. Thanks, Mary. I'm sorry for the loss of you both, your parents. You know, when somebody has something so serious and life-limiting as metastatic cancer, at some point in time, they will die. That's almost stating the obvious. I find we in medicine, in our quest to preserve life and to give the best care possible to our patients, always ask the patient or their family if they want the next complication treated. You know, if someone we love, our father or mother, now with metastatic cancer has a fever and has a pneumonia, the question comes, well, do you want us to treat the pneumonia? Or maybe the treatment's just started almost automatically, and then we're told about it and asked, well, we could not treat it, I guess. Or if somebody has some bleeding from their stomach, from an ulcer or their bowel, we can try to do some surgery to stop it, and we can provide transfusions. None of that's wrong, of course, but it all has to be thought about carefully, and decisions made in a shared manner with physicians, patients, and families, in a manner that acknowledges that, it's the old Roseanne Dana dictum. If it's not one thing, it's another thing, but it's always something.
Mm-hmm.
And nature gives us very gentle ways of leaving this life. Infection, for instance, they used to call pneumonia the old man's friend. Infection is one generally gentle way to leave this life. But every time in our quest to preserve life and out of our love for one another, every time we say, well, I can't let my dear mother or father die of something as simple to treat as a pneumonia, that's not wrong, but it also comes with another decision that is unspoken that says she therefore must die of something else. And as we close the doors to the gentle ways that people have, that nature gives us to die, we force the body to find other ways of dying. So if we won't allow someone to die of an infection, we won't allow them to die because they've stopped being able or even wanting to eat and drink normally. If we intervene with that, if we keep intervening, we put them on dialysis because we can't have them die of kidney failure, that none of that makes them immortal. But it does force the physiology of their bodies to find often more difficult ways for them to die. And along the way, the person lives with an ever larger burden of illness before they die. So what I see happening in this wonderful, frankly, hospital that I get to work in is that sometimes in our quest to keep people alive, we inadvertently but inescapably inflict more burden of illness and more suffering. Somebody once said, dying doesn't cause suffering. Resistance to dying causes suffering.
Hmm. So you've amplified. I was going to ask you what you meant when you said there are worse things than having someone you love die. Those worse things may be just what you mentioned.
Well, I think we can't imagine when someone we love is dying or might die, we cannot imagine anything worse than them dying. In fact, however, unfortunately, there are worse things than having someone you love die. Most basically, there's having someone you love die badly,
mm-hmm.
having them suffer.
Right. Oh, it's terrible. Yes.
And maybe worse than that, if there's anything worse than that, it's reflecting later and realizing that much of the person's suffering could have been avoided.
Right. Mary, thanks for your call. Is it Bale from Hickson? Hi, Bale.
Yes. I have been a hospice patient. I was a firefighter by vocation, and I was a patient for 6.5 months. I have now been off hospice 4 years. I've lived under medication for about 2 of those years. In the last 2 years, I've had very little medication. I've had over 70 heart attacks.
Whoa.
I wanted to comment that hospice, honestly, has done me a lot of good services, even though I haven't been with them for 4 years. I had the doctors and the medical people. They were going to let me die in the hospital, and I asked to leave, and they said I'd be dead in 4 days, one way or the other. And then one doctor thought he could medicate me out of the situation, and they did. But I do have situations with what they look at, do not resuscitate, and how people choose that. And I tried to take control of my own medical, and I have reduced my medicines to nothing, you know,
mm-hmm.
but one by one. But I do want to comment that people should look to hospice and have that help. And there are people that do live past it, even though they had a number of traumas like myself.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bayek.
I'm so glad that you called, Bale. You know, it's a well-kept secret that so often the work of hospice and palliative care actually helps people live longer. And there's actually now some studies. I've been telling stories of people that I know for years who lived longer because of hospice care. Now there's finally some research that confirms that, you know, in providing a real comprehensive attention to people's pain and their other physical discomforts, their nutrition, their skin care, their elimination, but also addressing people's worries, doing practical problem solving for them, supporting their families in caregiving. It's not uncommon. In fact, it's actually pretty common that with hospice care, people live longer. Now, that's a problem, and people in hospice care often sort of whisper that because of the Medicare regulations. Hospice programs can actually have some complexities with the regulations if their care causes people to live longer. But how bizarre is that?
Right.
So, you know, I think we need to fix the Medicare regulations that draw this artificial bright line between, you know, so-called curative medicine and so-called palliative medicine. There's actually just good medical care.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these silos that we've created with our regulations just need to be dissolved. And we need to be able to provide the best care possible for people, knowing that, you know, the current research shows that the work of palliative and hospice care, frankly, for someone like with advanced cancer, does every bit as well as things like Tarceva, these, you know, miracle drugs that really only extend life for 2 or 3 months in most cases. Well, we do that as well with many patients with hospice and palliative care.
Right. Thanks for the call, Georgia, and we have about a minute left from Lone Rock. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. I would like to say that talking about the subject is so important, and this type of show is extremely important.
Whoa, Georgia.
Oh, so sorry.
Oh, I know. I'm sorry. But talking about the subject, I think she's right that we don't spend a lot of time talking about this subject, and it's common. It's all
well,
going to happen to all of us.
It's time to grow the rest of the way up. You know,
I like that.
Life is precious, but we're mortal, and so we really need to figure out what it looks like to live not only as individuals, but in families and communities as, you know, as full, healthy, normal, but mortal human beings.
Does it change the way you live, do you think, Dr. Bayek, to be involved in the kind of work that you're doing, living knowing full well you're going to die?
I think it has impacted my personal life. I've learned to apologize, frankly, to people more quickly and more thoroughly. I don't want I know that I could be in a serious accident later today and could be seriously injured or even die, I want to make sure that there's nothing critically important left undone or unsaid between me and the people I love. I don't have to be dying for things to be necessary to say. I just have to be mortal. So, you know, I make sure that my wife and my daughters know that I forgive them for any the things that they've done that have bothered me in the past. I've asked them to forgive me for, you know, screwing up from time to time and being, you know, cranky or, you know, misstepping. And I wanted them to know how much I appreciate all they've done, appreciate
right.
them in my life, and that I love them.
Oh, that's good. And we should all live that way. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a fascinating hour. Dr. Ira Byock, Director of Palliative Care at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, Professor of Anesthesiology and Community and Family Medicine, author of Dying Well, The Prospect of Growth at the End of Life. Thanks, Chrissy Peace, for producing.